It's one of my favorite words. Not one of my favorite feelings, but one of my favorite words. Schadenfreude. Schadenfreude. First of all, it just sounds good. Comes from German. The literal translation is harm joy. And that's about what it means. Schadenfreude is the joy that you feel exulting in someone else's misery. Their pain is your gain. It's not a good-hearted emotion. There's no question about it. Schadenfreude comes from a dark place inside. It's oh so bad, but it feels oh so good. And by good, I don't mean good in a warm or fulfilling, heartwarming way. No, this is a cold emotion. Schadenfreude is cruel. Ha, ha, ha. If you're experiencing too much Schadenfreude in your life, you're probably a bitter human being. There is one place in our culture, though, where Schadenfreude is a little bit more accepted. And that's in the sports world. That's in the world that we exist. And within that subdivision, if you're spending time in a Las Vegas sports book, Schadenfreude is not only commonplace, it's generally accepted. That's where I was for the championship games on Sunday, the AFC and NFC championship games, and I got to experience Schadenfreude in so many different ways at the Caesars Sportsbook. Now, just the fact that I was there was because I couldn't win at something else, and so instead of trying to play for the Stratomatic World Championship, I was with my buddy Joe Sheehan and a couple of my other friends hanging out at the Caesars, making bets on the games and watching the football. So I was already in maybe not the most fulfilling place to begin with. And then when you're there and the tapestry of human zaniness goes past you, how can you help but experience a little bit of the joy in the misery of others? I have to share a couple examples with you of what I'm talking about. My first is the funniest, I think. The John Kuhn guys. So as you probably know, especially when you get down to the playoff games, there's not just the bet on the spread or whether a team's going to win or lose straight up or the points over or under. You also have the opportunity to bet prop bets, the bets that are about a specific thing. In this case, who's going to score the first touchdown in the game? And there's a little spreadsheet that Caesars and every other book will put out there for you. And every guy is weighted based on their probability of who might catch or run in that first touchdown. But it's a crapshoot. It's a fun little crapshoot. And as we're watching the NFC Championship game, the Packers on their first drive, they're driving and they've got the ball at the 1 yard line and they hand the ball off to John Kuhn. They do the inside handoff to the fullback, John Kuhn. And John Kuhn goes in, and he goes into the pile, and the near judge runs in. Touchdown! And these three guys, a row to our left at the sportsbook, three college-age guys, three Arizona State guys. I'm using a context clue of their black, sparky T-shirts there. They burst out of their seats. Oh, oh, John Kuhn. Oh, John Kuhn. These guys are celebrating like they just won the Super Bowl, which makes you look at the sheet. And John Kuhn is, well, I don't even have to look it up because now they're screaming it. 50 to 1. 50 to 1. 50 to 1. And me and Joe are looking at each other because probably these kids put down $5, right? But still, hey, $5 turns into $250. That's a lot of Jack in the Box late night munchie meals. That's some serious coin to the Arizona State boys. So they're wild. For Vegas, even for Vegas, way over the top celebration continues right through the replay of the touchdown. That shows all of us in the sports book simultaneously that John Kuhn's down at the half-yard line. He didn't score. He didn't come close to scoring. But our boys are not paying attention to that. They are paying attention to mentally spending all of their $250 or $500 or however many dollars that they thought they just won betting on John Kuhn. And then they saw the ref go under the hood. And then I experienced Schadenfreude. As I watched the three of them comically and almost literally drop to their knees, but literally give each, all three of them started frantically, repeatedly, and fervently giving themselves the sign of the cross. And then it broke down, and two guys were giving themselves the sign of the cross, and the other one had his hands clasped in prayer, and he was kneeling back and forth and kind of rocking and rocking and praying and rocking with his eyes closed. And I'm like, guys, first of all, I'm not sure that God accepts instant replay prayers. And if he does, I don't think you're winning. That was Schadenfreude. And as the ref comes out from under the hood and proclaims to no one's surprise except for these three that, in fact, John Kuhn is short, I couldn't even watch the TV. I could only watch them. I could only keep my eyes on them. As with chins dropped, mouths agape, eyes downcast or staring glazed at the screen, the three of them silently took the bad news and waited almost the perfect comic length of time, about three beats. Give it to him again! Give it to him again! They didn't give it to him again. Schadenfreude complete. So when I'm experiencing this much Schadenfreude, you know it's going to come back on me, and it absolutely did in the night game, because the Patriots are playing the Colts. I'm in a survivor pool that I've been in all year long, and if the Colts win that game, I'm in line to win some money, some decent money. Not life-changing money by any means, but vacation money. You know, good enough money you could take a vacation on it. Good money. And, you know, 5 minutes into that game, you knew the Colts weren't going to win. Even when they got an interception and went back and made it a one-touchdown game, you knew the Colts weren't going to win. That wasn't going to happen. And I knew that wasn't going to happen, which was why I bet the Patriots in the second half. But I also had the under. I had the under both for the second half and the under for the game overall. And there was a smart reason for that. There was sideways rain. It made perfect sense that the game was going to slow down in the second half. And when I was yelling at Tom Brady to take a knee when he was at the 25 of the Colts going in, trying to make a 38-7 game 45-7 and thus kill all my under bets, and my buddy Joe's sitting there with the over bet watching me make a fool out of myself, that's when Schadenfreude came back and I was the one being laughed at. And of course, as a San Diegan, I hate the Patriots. And asking the Patriots to make me money on an AFC Championship Sunday was probably a fool's errand to begin with. And we're left with the Patriots and the Seahawks in the Super Bowl. And that gets me to what can be my favorite Schadenfreude in all of sports. Watching the Patriots lose in the Super Bowl. It's the ultimate Schadenfreude. I stand nothing to gain from it. My team doesn't win at their expense. My team's not even in it. I just really like it when they come so close and lose. From the Mighty 1090. Mighty1090.com, my kitchen table in the darkest recesses of my mind. This is the Craig Elston Podcast. That would make me Craig Elston. This is podcast number 2.
Welcome to it.
Thanks to everyone who listened to the first podcast with Ted Leitner. If you missed it, go back through the Mighty1090.com archives to find it. A lot of great feedback that I've received, a lot of positive feedback. Right off the top, I'll just let you know where some of the technical things that you've brought up to me, we're working on it. We're working on it. So, yes, this podcast will be available by iTunes sooner than later. Need to rack up a couple. I was told about, I think it's called Stitcher. We'll do that. We're going to do that. We're going to figure out all the way. It needs to be a podcast on the 1090 app. It's going to have its own spot on the website. Working on it. Work in progress. I think the folks at 1090 are figuring out what they've got here. I hope so. We are excited. And just bear with us as we get to it, get to the point where the pod is in its most streamlined and efficient delivery system possible, where you can enjoy it. You know, just open up your phone and find it right there. We will have that for you sooner than later. Sooner than later. Thanks for putting up with the delivery system in the interim. We're talking to Randy Jones today. Awesome, right? Talking to Randy Jones, what else would you want to do? Ted Leitner, pod number one. Randy Jones, pod number two. We're talking San Diego. We're talking about a guy that helped put the Padres on the map on the national scene by winning the Cy Young Award in 1976, by appearing in the All-Star Game in 75 and then starting it in 1976. Talking about a guy whose career, though it was injury-shortened, he managed to extend into a career off the field as an entrepreneur, as a businessman, as a brand, Randy Jones the brand. I've always had so much respect for Randy for that. I've known him since 2000 when we first worked together on Padres pre- and post-game, working at a different place. I've known him for 15-plus years, and I've always been amazed at how Randy keeps himself in the conversation, keeps himself relevant. A lot of guys wouldn't have gone down that road. Randy's done it, and he's been able to keep himself front and center in what's happening in the San Diego sports scene, even decades later. I was going to do the essay today on the Padres offseason. Given the time of year, I'm going to do something a little bit more in-depth on the Padres and what they've done so far on a future podcast as we get closer into pitchers and catchers and that time. I'll just say this right here. The single best thing the Padres did this winter was shift the conversation. And that was probably one of the hardest things that they could try to do. And they did that. For a week in this winter, when in a normal year, the San Diego sports world would be 100% focused on the Chargers and a must-win game to get into the playoffs, everyone was talking about nothing but the Padres. And that was due to A.J. Preller. That was due to a direction that was approved by ownership and upper management. And I give them a ton of credit for that. They gave Padre fans who have really not had a lot of great things to chew on over the past few years, they gave them the ultimate holiday present, the possibility of a different future. Now, in the giddiness of the moment, evaluating the actual moves themselves, you know, I did wonder if A.J. Preller's laptop had a spreadsheet open of possible corner outfielder trades and it got stuck on select all and he just made all of them at once. There's no question the pods are better. I don't know that they are better than the Giants or the Dodgers. We'll talk about that more down the road. But be content right now embracing this direction if you're a Padres fan, because the direction has shifted. The focus has changed. The Padres are trying to compete. Whether they have reached their ideal goal yet, not sure. That's what they're trying to do. Really psyched about that. We are not really going to talk a lot about the current Padres with Randy Jones. That's why I'm putting that out there in between. We're going to talk about Randy, his life, his career, how he developed his style. There is an anecdote about the Rifleman that I think you're going to want to stay tuned to hear. It's all coming your way. And hey, a real quick note as we get started here, as you're about to hear, and this is entirely my fault. I had, inside the computer, you got to do the input, the output, and I had it wrong. So while Randy and I were sitting in a room with headsets on, If you're listening to this and going, it sounds like it's just like they put a microphone in between the two of them, that's because that's what, as it turned out, it actually happened. Luckily, and I've listened through it, with two guys with pretty loud radio voices, everything turned out fine. You're going to hear it just fine, completely worthy of presentation, but just wanted to let you know, yes, you're not hearing things. Yes, it. Yeah, that's a computer mic right in the middle of an empty conference room that luckily had good acoustics. So, again, Randy Jones. I know my friend Randy Jones has stayed busy in the off season because if you're not busy, you're not breathing.
Well, you know, Greg, the great thing about this winter, I think, finally, is I took some time off, a little more quality time with family.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, I didn't do as much bird hunting. I went on a few trips, but I've got a new little puppy, and unfortunately, I signed my favorite lab for 13 years. I had to put him down at the end of the season, so. I immediately went up north to California, picked up a little British Spaniel puppy, 4 months old, brought him home. And so I've been bonding with him this whole winter. Spent a lot of hours with him and training him. Been very, very positive, but he kind of put me around my granddaughters a little bit more.
Yeah.
Not so much the rush to work,
let's
put it that way. And, you know, without a sports grill and other things, you know, in my diverse, you know, occupation, you might say. Give me a little more time off, and I think I really enjoyed it. I kind of need to write this winter, maybe. Let me put it that way.
Yeah.
I'm ready to get back to work.
You know, it's funny. I've jot down a bunch of notes on a bunch of different spots, just various launching platforms, and you would probably not be surprised, seeing as you know I know you at least a little bit, that under personal, the second thing I wrote down was dogs.
Yes.
Because it was seeing you, I think, back at the old studios at the other place, bringing in your dogs, and I've met a couple, CJ, right?
Didn't you? No,
RJ. Sigh, RJ.
In fact, this new one is RJ again.
RJ2?
Yes.
We got RJ2. And your love for those dogs, that is something that's really, really deep inside, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I've always had an opportunity to train dogs and build a rapport with the animal, and, I mean, they're my buddies.
Who is your first dog?
Oh, what you mean when I was a kid?
Yeah, your first dog.
I had a little Cocker Spaniel. That's what it was, and Mom and Dad gave it to me, and they called it, we called him Mitzi. I remember Mitzi. I had Mitzi for 14 years. And then when I got a little bit older, I got my first bird dog, which was a British Spaniel.
Uh-huh.
Trained him, and we started there. His name was Sweets. And then I had my first RJ right after that. It was a Brittany. And then I had RJ Jr., so, actually, the Brittany I have now is really RJ the third, you might say.
Okay.
But Bree and I, all the way home, we went up to Red Bluff to pick up the puppy and drive it all the way home. We're trying to figure out a different name. And so, after about 300 miles, I looked at her and said, oh, hell, it's going to be RJ. Let's go. But, you know, it's always been something special, that rapport. I'm an avid bird hunter. I like to get outdoors like that and go bird hunting. There's just nothing better than a good dog to share it with.
Yeah.
But you gotta kind of live it to love it. It's one of those things, and I really do love doing it. And I'm looking forward to this little guy. He's 6 months old now, and he'll be ready next big bird season after the end of baseball season. He'll be ready to go. But I've got the whole summer, and I look forward to it, to training him and getting him ready.
So you, oh boy, you have just been in your space, your good space.
I really have. You know, it's been just great, you know, watching this young guy. In fact, a great example, come over to see you. I jumped in the truck, and he was sitting there, a little six-month-old dog going, don't I get to go? And I said, not this time. You know, he's got to learn that he doesn't go every single time. But boy, he's been with me almost the last 3 months solid.
So that I am going to take you all the way back. Well, how old were you when you first got that dog?
You mean Mitzi?
Yeah, Mitzi.
I had to be
name of my wife, by the way.
I was 7 or 8.
7 or 8 years old.
Yeah.
What did your dad do?
My dad actually he was a general manager and ran a called Leffingwell Chemical. They made agricultural nutrients and fertilizers.
Uh huh.
And I should know a lot about it because, you know, guess where I worked. You know, I worked at Leffingwell Wall Chemical. But he did that his whole life and ran that operation for probably 34 years.
Wow.
Before he retired. And, you know, always had time. He, you know, worked every day, a lot of times 7 days a week if he had to get it done. And, you know, maybe that's where I got my work at.
I was just going to ask, is that where you got it?
I think so.
Yeah. It almost has to be.
Yeah.
What kind of wife puts up with a guy that works that hard?
Yeah, and the nice thing is it kind of seemed like it all started when, you know, Marie and I got married, and next thing I knew, I signed professionally, and, you know, it's just part of our lives. It's what we did.
Wow. What did your mom do? Did she just run
a house? My mom worked as well right there in Orange County at Kirk Hill Rubber Company, and she was a secretary there and doing diverse things for them, and she worked there for, I would say, 30 years.
So two working parents that worked hard in business, and that instills in you early on that it's not going to be something that's going to come to you easy.
No. Yes, exactly. And in hard work, it was just something that seemed like to be in my family. I remember my dad for quite a few years. He owned a gas station as well. And so he'd get off work at 3 o'clock, and at 4 o'clock, he would be at the Flying A gas station right there in the corner of Imperial and Brayla Boulevard. He owned it. He was a mechanic and, you know, a chief cook and bottle washer. He'd work there till 11 o'clock. He'd come home, get a few hours sleep, get back up, go to work.
Get right back out.
Yeah.
Now, and one thing I did not know, I mean, I've known Marie as long as I've known you.
Right.
And she is the rock, I think we'd agree.
Sure.
You met before you were even a probate. How'd you meet?
We were high school sweethearts.
High school sweethearts. Yeah. At Braille.
At Braille. And I was, I knew, you know, I knew Marie, not quote unquote who she was, let me put it that way. And her freshman year, I was a sophomore in high school. And I wanted to ask her out, but I had to wait. I got my driver's license in January of my sophomore year in high school. So right after I got my driver's license, I asked her for a date. So,
what was your first car?
I had a 43 Willie Jeep. It was an old Jeep that I'd restored. That was my car.
And you had put your own hands on it.
You know, in fact, I ended up painting it yellow. It was bright yellow Jeep.
Proud of that Jeep.
We'd go to the beach. We'd go everywhere. And I had that for a couple of years, and then I finally I traded that in with my mom and dad's help and got me a 66 Mustang that I drove for all my high school, you know, the rest of my high school days.
So you meet, you're a sophomore, she's a freshman.
Yes.
And you dated through college, or?
Yes, obviously dated when I was at Chapman, and we actually got married my junior year.
At Chapman.
At Chapman.
Right on.
So.
How did you know for sure?
Well, you just know. You know, I think we all have a story about that, but she was just an integral part of my life. And I just knew that, you know, she's talking about going to college. And I went, now this is insane. That woman should not be in college. And that's when I asked her to marry me, and I got married my junior year. I just knew it was the right fit, and I wanted her with me. So anyway, it worked out great.
And at that moment when you're doing that, do you think you're going to go be a pro baseball player?
No.
No?
No.
You even when you're because you're pitching at Chapman,
right?
You're doing okay. Right?
I'm doing well.
You're doing well, but you don't think there's a shot that you're going to go pro from that?
Well, there was a possibility I might be a pro baseball player.
Yeah,
but you know, I had a backup plan,
which was
well, I spent two summers playing semi-professional baseball up in Anchorage, Alaska, and living up there. In fact, my second year up there, we were married, so Marie came up and spent a month with me. In Alaska, staying with the family that I stayed with, the Johnsons, and so Marie just stayed with us, and you know, we've been, you know, friends this whole time, you know, since the early 70s, 70, 71. And anyway, Jack Johnson, who I live with up there, is in real estate and did a lot of real estate with the government, you know, with Alaska. And so I had a kind of a standing job. I had my degree before I signed professionally, And so, hey, if this doesn't work out, I'm going to move up to Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm going to work in the real estate business for the state of Alaska. That was going to be my job.
That's your alternate reality.
I was just going to go make my fortune up there.
Do you think barbecue sells quite as well?
Yeah. How things can change. How diverse can you get?
Would have been Randy Jones' whitefish come with you.
Well, you know, it was 73, the year that I got called up. you know, in the back of my mind, I was in the Texas League, and that was going to be my last year. I mean, if I didn't make it that year, or think at the end of the season that I even had a chance in 74, I was going to take that job. I was going up there.
Because it was a surer thing for you.
Well, sure. I mean, you throw 84 miles an hour max, you know, and, I mean, you know how to pitch, and you don't know where it's going to take you. So I went out and had fun, you know, in 73, just going out pitching, doing what I do. And now, one thing led to another.
I want to find out now kind of how you got into the game. When you were growing up, was baseball something you always loved to do? Because you're an outdoorsy guy to me, but was that something that was primary for you? Was that your first sport?
It was my first love.
It was?
It really was. I mean, I'm sure I played basketball. I played football through the ranks. Like, I didn't care what I did in high school.
Yeah.
My era. But it was always baseball season. That's when I got the most excited. That was my passion. I love baseball.
Was your dad someone who pushed you to baseball?
No, no one had to push me.
Yeah.
No, he supported me. He was my little league coach.
Okay.
He didn't know what he was doing. I loved it, so he coached me. God bless him. He was great.
Who was your first great coach?
Not my first great coach?
Yeah, the first coach that really helped you.
Don Terranova was his name. He was my coach my senior year in high school, honestly.
Huh.
He's the one that actually, you know, worked, changed all my mechanics. I knew that I wasn't going to get a football scholarship or a basketball scholarship, so I didn't play football or basketball my senior year. I dedicated that whole year to baseball, and I was out there at 6:30 PE. I was out there every single day, working on my craft. And Don Terranova, you know, just he redid all my mechanics, and I bought into it, and I worked really, really hard.
Were you always a pitcher?
Yeah, I pitched or I played outfield.
Yeah.
You know,
but pitching was the thing.
Pitching was the thing.
When's the first time that clicked for you? I mean, it could have been 7 years old striking out a kid in the sandlot. I don't care.
It was 7 years old.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Pull that number out of my butt.
Pee Wee League. Yeah. It's 1957. And in fact, at home, I've got my two proudest trophies are one from Pee Wee League champs from 1957, and the other one's a Cy Young Award.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of years in between that, a lot of pitches. But I just remember a guy named John Matlack was my coach, my very first coach. And what we did for those Pee Wee League games is he'd walk by the house and we'd walk up to the field to play our Pee Wee League games. The umpire actually stood behind me on the mound.
Okay, yeah, I've been a Little League umpire having to do that.
Yeah, and that's where he was when I first started. But I think we played 14 games that summer. In Pee Wee League, I think I got to pitch 10 of them.
Wow.
And, you know, I just fell in love with it.
Who was the pitcher you loved? Now, you were a SoCal guy.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I'm trying to think along similar lines who that person might be. I mean, Sandy Koufax was around when you were around.
He was, you know, when we got to the 60s.
Yeah.
And Sandy Koufax. And I even remember that now I'm 12, 13. And
right.
It was Sandy Koufax that I loved to watch. And I mean, I literally got to go up to, you know, Dodger Stadium and watch Sandy Koufax pitch. It was really exciting. It was just phenomenal. And, you know, didn't throw anything near like him, but, you know.
Is that what you were picturing for yourself, though? I'm going to go out there and blow these guys out?
I knew I couldn't do that. I mean, I threw the ball well, and I knew how to pitch. And that was the one key thing. You know, I love my craft. I love doing it.
All right, so... Randy, something that's always fascinated me. You've always been, to me, a guy who knew who he was for the entirety of his career. Meaning, like, you knew what you could do, and you understood what you couldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hey, and you always talk about it. I knew I couldn't throw 94. I knew I could. At what point did that part of it click in for you? Because normally, from everyone I know in baseball, they usually get that beaten out of them. You know what I mean? School of Hard Knocks teaches you that you have to pitch a certain way to succeed.
You know, I think it was probably right after my I had some tendonitis problems, you know, my junior year in high school, and I missed a little time. I couldn't pitch. And when I came back, I lost a little bit of edge on the fastball. Still had a pretty decent high school fastball.
Yeah.
You know, but I found that even during my senior year in high school, it just really wasn't quite the same, but I just had great pinpoint control. And being a left-handed, you know, the fastball always tailed, moved a little bit. And so then when I got to college my freshman year, I, I think that's when I kind of first started. I mean, a lot of guys do a lot harder than me, but, you know, I just had a knack for hitting good spots, corners. And then I started playing around with changing speeds a little bit and had some success with it. And I think that just got better and better. Like I plateaued maybe my sophomore year in college, and it stayed, you know, pretty consistent. But then again, that same tendon I aggravated in my junior year in college and missed two-thirds of the season. Mm-hmm. But then I went back out that summer in Alaska and ended up being 15-1 over the summertime, and we were the national champions in Wichita. And so I came back from my senior year in college. And that's, I think that was the year really where kind of everything came together. It wasn't overpowering. You know, I worked on a little bit more movement and just setting guys up. But I always had great control, and that's what I was successful.
And you had that sinker.
Yeah. Well, the sinker, you know, wasn't so effective actually until I signed professionally.
Really?
It was cool. Warren Hacker. Actually, the start of 70, I mean, I had a good, don't get me wrong, I had a good one in 72, my senior year in college, and I went out and played the Texas League. And, you know, a good tail and fastball with a little bit of sink, you know, but nothing like, you know, what happened in 73 with Warren Hacker. Kind of talked me into kind of rolling the ball over my fingers and getting it to sink a little bit more. I started playing around with it, and, you know, and I kept throwing it. He goes, look at that sink. And I kept looking. I didn't see nothing. I'm going, whatever you say, you know, I'll buy it. But then after a while, once the season started, I got into Louisiana and the Texas League, and the first couple of starts, and everything just fell into place. And it was just so natural. It was just a natural motion to me, it felt like. And, you know, now all of a sudden I had another weapon, in my opinion. And then it just set everything else up, especially for the minor league caliber, double-A ball. And just, you know, kept hitting the outside corner, that little sinker ball, all of a sudden, you know, with my control of the curveball and the slider, that just was really, really effective.
And then that's enough for the Padres to see that they've got a reason to bring you up in 73.
Yeah, well, it was just timing. I mean, they wanted to sign Dave Winfield. So Freddie Norman was one of our starting pitchers on the big league staff. Well, they sold Freddie Norman to the Cincinnati Reds for cash so they could sign Dave Winfield. And that left a void for a left-handed starting pitcher. I was 8-1 at the time, you know, down in the Texas League. And I think I'd walked three guys in 78 innings. And Don Zimmer, you know, saw that. And he goes, well, look, dude, bring up that left-handed who's only walked three guys. I want to see Jones. And that's how I got my opportunity there. When Freddie Norman left, I left that void for a left-handed pitcher, and that's where I got my opportunity. Now, and you might say I made the most of it.
Yeah, you certainly did. Now, you've told this story to me before or on the air before, but some folks are coming in for the first time. So your first time on the mound in the big leagues is a little bit of a trial by fire.
Oh, Lord. Well, you know, I joined the team in Montreal. They're on the road. And so from Texas, Amarillo, Texas, I joined the team in Montreal. And we played a couple of games there, threw a little bullpen. Didn't even get a scare there, but we went to New York, played the Mets right after that. And, I think it was the last game, we were getting beat like 10-0. And the next thing I know, I'm warming up, and I'm going in the seventh to pitch the seventh inning, you know, scared to death. And so I went up there. I remember the first guy I faced was Jim Fregosi. That's why I do remember that. It was a long time ago, so don't go there. I remember Jim Fregosi hit a ground ball, you know, with prototypical, you know, a ground ball for out one. And there was a pop-up, and I think it was Jerry Grote, you know, the catcher, hit another ground ball. You know, three up, three down, I'm out of the inning. And so, fine, and, you know, like I say, we go 1-2-3. And so I go out and pitch the eighth inning. And I remember our number one pick at the time, Dave Roberts, was our third baseman.
Yep.
Behind the plate was Chris Canizero. And so they throw the ball around, and Dave Roberts runs up and flips me the ball, and he goes, you see who your first hitter is? And I look up, and it's Willie Mays leading off the eighth, you know. And here I am as a 23-year-old kid going, dang, you know, 72 hours ago, man, I was in Amarillo, Texas. So anyway, I got Mays 1-2, threw him a couple of pretty good pitches, tried to get cute and throw him a sinker ball down and in, and I left it over the inner third. And they still haven't found that baseball. He hit it so hard. I mean, it just disappeared in the night, in, you know, over the left field bullpen. I mean, just killed it.
Now, when you see that ball going into disappearing like a white dot into a black into a black vacuum, right? Yeah. And it's gone. Is part of you impressed? You just gave up a homer to Willie Mays.
Yeah. After about 10 seconds, I watch him. Wow. And he's running around the bases. I go, well, if you're going to do it, might as well be him. And that's my first thought. You know, then basically, I didn't get out of the inning. Because, you know, I'm a little bit shell-shocked. I'm nervous as hell.
Sure.
And so I faced a couple of guys. One guy popped up. I gave him a base hit, and Zimmer came and got me. You know, and he had a smirk on his face, too. You know, like he was over the guy. And so I got back over there, and Bob Miller was one of our bullpen guys, and he's the one that, before I went out, he goes, hey, whatever you do, kids, go out there and throw strikes. And so I come in, and he looks up at me, and I go, well, that was real good advice. And the whole bench start busting up, and they're patting me on the back, you know. But, you know, that's initially started it. And, of course, then 4 days later, we went back home after the game, and it was just great, because I got, you know, my wife there, my family, and everybody's so excited, you know, and all this. And so I'm pitching against the Atlanta Braves 4 days later at San Diego Stadium.
Yeah.
You know, I'll just never forget, you know, Marie was just scared to death, and you know, I think she was. I was scared to death, too, my first start in the big leagues. And, of course, I go out there in the first inning and give up a home run to Hank Aaron.
So now you have already started your collector set of Hall of Famers with home runs allowed to.
Boy, Jones, don't mess around, man. And I got out of, when I got out of the first inning, I come running in. I looked over at Zimmer, and he just busted up. And he goes, man, Lifty, you don't mess around, do you? You know? And I go, man, I can hardly move my face in next. You
know? Yeah, exactly.
Busted up. And I ended up getting, I got beat 3-1 that day, doing 7 innings. But that's when Randy Jones realized that he could pitch at the big league level.
Yeah.
And that's when I realized in my own mind, in my own heart, you know, I can get these guys out. You know, they have weaknesses, and I have the control and the ability to attack those weaknesses. And once I realized that, you know, that started my career. That was exciting.
Now, that faith had to be tested the next year.
Oh.
When you lose 22 ball games.
Yes. Yeah, it was. That was a lot of soul searching after that, and recommit, I think. And, you know, I lost my confidence.
At what point in the year?
Well, I think I was 7-13 at All-Star break.
Hmm.
And so I ended up 8-22. So that gives you an idea. I went 1-9
down the stretch.
And it seemed like every time I looked up, it would be this like the sixth inning or the start of the seventh, and it'd be 1-1, 2-2, or, you know, when my guy's getting my tail just kicked in all the time. But it seemed like late in the game, I would get tired, I'd elevate the ball, make a mistake, and I'd get beat. And I lost my confidence.
So you know me. I'm the guy who always goes into the numbers, right?
Yeah.
I always take a look. So I love looking at your numbers. I love looking at your numbers because some of them will just blow your mind, and those we are still to talk about. But in 1974, you set your career high for strikeouts and walks.
Yeah.
That season, your walk rate that year was over 3 per 9 innings, which is by far the highest of the prime of your career.
Right. Yeah, and it is basically, you know, losing that confidence. And I went out there and I was kind of hoping I did well. I'd really lost my whole perspective that I had in 73 and early 74. I mean, I just lost my confidence. I think I was overthrowing the baseball and just doing things that weren't me. And probably the biggest change is getting Tom Morgan as a pitching coach after the 74 season. And him wanted to make a few fundamental changes in me that I bought into.
Because at that point,
I was looking for something.
Right.
And I started seeing more consistent results.
Was it something simple? Was it moving you one side of the rubber?
Yeah,
the other,
just getting technical. Yeah, just moving a little bit and changing the arm angle, throwing a little bit more of a stiff front leg, and finishing pitches every single pitch. No straight up and down, but stronger legs, build more endurance, you know, so I didn't get tired. I really thought one of the key things is I'd be good for 5 or 6 innings, and then that's when I got tired, I'd get beat up. I think it was just kind of some poor mechanics that I'd gotten into. And when I bought into this part and went into spring training, I felt a lot better about it. But I still had to work on that, the confidence side of it. But that spring, it really made a difference. I mean, I went out and I'm not sure I gave up a run that whole spring.
Really?
I pitched about 35 innings. You know, I was out there a lot and I just had a lot of confidence. I did so well that I was announced starting pitcher opening day. And I looked at John McNamara, manager. I don't think I want to be that good. You know, coming up,
right?
Two losses.
Yeah.
But anyway, I ended up, and I gave an opening day of it was Jim Barnes, the Giants. I was facing Jimmy, and I went 9 innings, gave up 4 hits, and looked up the scoreboard. It's still 0-0. I got another decision.
Wow.
But you know, that was really the start that catapulted me into the year that I had in 75.
Now, one thing I noticed, and this is just kind of a funny quirk of your era, but if people want to go watch Randy Jones pitch, mm-hmm. not as easy as you might think.
All right.
Your YouTube clip reel, let me tell you, it's not too big. They've got you nailing down the ninth of the All-Star of the All-Star game.
Exactly.
It's about a 55-second clip.
And you can find a few sequences of pictures from the 76 All-Star game.
Yeah.
I think that's about it.
That is about it. And it's always killed me because I know you would have been the pitcher, especially in our job now, that I would have loved to have been there to watch, because you knew that game was going to be moving. Who was it, with high school, college, where that you locked in your tempo as a pitcher?
I had the tempo was, probably my sophomore year in college. I started working pretty quick.
Yeah,
pitching a little more to contact, but I think that even quickened up to 75, honestly. Like Tom Morgan took over, wanted me to work a little bit faster, run on and off the mound.
Mm-hmm.
I bought into the whole thing. I liked the idea of controlling the tempo of the game is what I felt like. Sometimes you have to be really careful too, because you work that fast, man, you don't have good stuff, and you give up a bunch of runs really fast.
Right, right.
Before they even get another arm loose.
Base hit.
Hold on. Second, third. Uh-oh. Now 6-0. Didn't have it today. Didn't happen too often, knock on wood.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it did have its moments, it probably wasn't to my advantage.
Now, if you were to look at pitchers who have pitched in, let's say, the last 20 years and say, one of those guys reminds me of me. Is it Mark Burley for the pace? Is it Jamie Moyer for the assortment of pitchers?
I think it's a blend of both.
Yeah.
Those two are great. And as far as movement and stuff, it'd probably be Greg Maddux.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the movement that he had on his ball and, how he dissected hitters.
Right.
Changed speed so well. I think it's probably a blend of all those. Burley, because how quick he works.
Right.
No doubt. Moyer, you're right, because of all the off-speed stuff. But
he was more of a looper than you, right?
Right? Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I just, I pitched to contact more than any of those guys. Yeah. I wanted you to hit the baseball. I did not want to throw you 5 pitches. So it just didn't make any sense.
Well, it was like 3 your number. Like, I want to be in or out in 3, pretty much.
Yeah, 3 pitches, and I should get you out in 3 pitches unless I'm not hitting my spots. You get deep in the count. That's going to happen in baseball. But more times than not, first sinker ball is going to look just like the third one. So maybe I'm going to go whack at that one.
I read an old interview of yours, and the word you used to describe what you liked about setting up a hitter was conniving.
Yeah.
And I loved that when I read it, because I thought that spoke to me, to the Randy I know, a guy who's going to outwit you on the mound.
Yeah, and it was just, watching a hitter, his mannerisms, when he first got into the box, what he might do on this pitch or that pitch. I remember Bill Russell one day, it was just awful. He was leaning so bad on that sinker ball, on the outside part of the plate. And it was 1-2, and I'm halfway through my windup, and I got a grin on my face because I'm throwing him a slider. And he's already starting to lean, looking on the outside. I just shattered. He barely hit the ball hard enough to throw him out. The shortstop had to run in and throw him out. I just sawed his bat off. For me to do that, that's just embarrassing. There's no doubt in my mind that the dugout had to be all over him. He goes, how does he do that to you?
Right. And you saw it coming.
Oh, yes. And he's just many, many times I would see this movement, one little thing, like Johnny Bench, he gets that thing where he's sitting on the slider. He just waited for me to throw that slider down and in. And he was just going to, turn on it, because he had that quick bat. And I didn't throw him a slider for 3 years.
He just was still waiting for it.
He was still waiting for it. That's how disciplined all those guys. But The one thing about hitters, though, it was just being able to change speeds, you know, with the sinker ball, you know, predominantly. And, you know, I'd be close and they'd foul tip it or whatever. And change a little bit of the speeds, move it maybe off the plate just a little bit more to get that ground ball, whatever I had to do.
So when you're working through the mental part of setting up hitters and taking them down, how much of that was instinctive in the moment, recognizing, like you said, maybe something physical, a slight physical tendency while you're live at the plate? How much of that was pregame, like scouting reports, tendencies, those type of things?
No, hardly none.
So it was in the game.
It was in the game.
Yeah.
And I had a pretty good idea how it wasn't rocket science. I faced the Cincinnati Reds, you know, four or five times every year.
Right.
So they know what I'm going to pitch, and I know where their weaknesses are.
Right.
You know, but, you know, the big things like that sinker ball on the outside parts of the right-handers, you know, number one, am I going to throw at 82? Is it going to be 74? Maybe, you know, 80? I would just change speeds on it all the time. And I had that ability to hit the same spot at different speeds. You know, and then when am I going to sneak that slider in on your hands?
Yeah.
It's just the game inside the game is what it was. Yeah. And a lot of times you're wasting one pitch. Like I get Pete Rose 2-0 on purpose.
Really?
Well, because Pete Rose, you know, knew that, hey, I got to throw him a fastball 2-0. I got to throw a strike, right? Problem is he didn't realize he made like 73 miles an hour and the bottom was going to fall out of it. And he hit another ground ball to short or second. He gets so frustrated with me.
So you're throwing a pitch outside on purpose. You're dirting one on purpose. Because then you're setting him up to think that he's going to get the pitch he wants.
Yeah. And I throw him the perfect sinker ball right down the middle, and the bottom would fall out of it, and he'd get a ground ball.
No wonder you're good at poker. Third-level thinker. That's what they talk about, thinking about what the opponent thinks about what you're going
to
think
it's
about.
It's just like, you know, if I want to miss off the plate, all I had to do was the sinker ball's overthrow it. If I overthrew the ball would not sink as much. It would just tail off the plate.
Right.
And so I'd just run it off the plate.
Now, when you get the chance to be – you go for – and by the way, folks, you can look this up. I Googled 20-game loser, 20-game winner, right?
Yeah.
You're actually the only guy who – in the modern era, okay, because, you know, if we go back to the, you know, in the late 1800s, right,
yeah.
Guys are 31-26, you know, like they just pitched every game and got every result. But you're the only guy who lost 20 and then won 20 back-to-back.
Right.
Yeah, other guys have done it, lost 20, won 20. Other guys have won 20, lost 20. Hell, Phil Niekro did both in the same year, twice.
That's right.
But you lost 20, won 20 in a row, back-to-back seasons. Is it at the All-Star game at 75 that you're like, okay, yes, now I know that this transition, all the stuff that happened in 74, the loss of confidence, was that where you felt like you were back on top of the mountain?
Yeah, it was gone.
Yeah.
Probably right before the All-Star game. You know, got a little nervous there, you know, because the first half was really good. I was 11-4. And not knowing that I'm destined for 20 wins, and maybe I'm on pace, I wasn't even thinking about that.
Right.
I was just thinking about getting the baseball every start and going out and making a quality start and trying to win a ball game.
I got to imagine at the break, you're thinking about I was 1-9 last year after the break. I got to keep this going.
No, that never even came up in my mind.
Really? Good.
I was that locked into, you know, I think the opportunity to pitch in the ninth inning in the All-Star game, getting a save. And next thing I know, I was on the mound starting, and it just catapulted me into the second half.
Mm.
And actually, I think I probably threw the baseball as good as I can that second half of 75.
Yeah.
Threw the ball really well.
I mean, your numbers for 75, those are your best.
Yes. Yeah, they were.
That was unbelievable. And tell me about the winner going from 75 to 76. What are you thinking about that winner?
I went in the Cy Young.
But yeah, so you were there. That's where your mind was.
Oh,
you were at the top then.
I knew the formula how to win.
Mm-hmm.
I knew my niche. I knew how Randy Jones needed, what he needed to do. And that was in the back of my mind. As soon as I got to spring training, when I started running in January, there in Poway, just running 5 or 6 miles every morning, that's what was on my mind.
So you set that goal from the start, and then you completed that goal. Along the way, a couple of things happened that year. You set a record for or tied a record for fielding. You turned 12 double plays in one season. What your fielding acumen, and you brought up Greg Maddux earlier. Maddux was a guy who finished in perfect fielding position every time and had those snap quick reflexes. in the very little video I can see, you're finishing in a really good fielding position.
I did. Yes, I did. And I had to. I mean, it was imperative. You're going to pitch to contact, and you're going to keep throwing right-handed hitters on the outside part of the plate. You know, you got to react to the ball. You got to become that infielder you're supposed to be. And it was crucial for me, I beat St. Louis 1-0 on a one-hitter. And the one hit was actually a ball off my glove for an infield single by Luis Melendez. And it was a way off to my right, though, and it just tipped off my glove. Couldn't believe it. 9 times out of 10, I catch that ball. And it goes for a base hit, and that was the only hit I gave up.
So it's your fault we've never had a no-hitter.
I'll take all the fire, man.
I've been cursing Clay Kirby and Preston Gomez all this time.
Well, you can blame him, too. Yeah. but that was an incredible game. But, I anticipated the ball being hit to me every time. It's not that I ever got burned, but I think there was a couple of times in spring training where I had the ball surprise me. And I go back to 75 where the ball surprised me, and I didn't like that feeling. I hated it. And I said, I got to be smarter than this. I got to be better than this on the mound. And, from then on, I was really aware of myself. And every time I threw a pitch, I anticipated it being hit at me. Hmm. The ball never surprised me again.
Now, it was again before the All-Star break in 76. June 22, 76, Randy, you tie a record, a Major League Baseball record, that was set by Christy Mathewson.
Right.
You go 68 straight innings without a walk.
Right.
And, again, this is the third time, folks, that we can bring up Greg Maddux, because eventually Greg Maddux breaks your streak.
That is correct.
I believe we were working together at that time. I remember you talking about it when he broke your streak. Now, you set the record. You end the seventh inning with a strikeout. You set the record, or you tie the record, 68 innings.
Yeah.
You come out to start the eighth. You walk the leadoff, man.
Yeah.
What the hell?
I mean, and you know what's funny? And I told everybody, I didn't know what inning it was. I didn't know where I was on the record. But I blame Roger Craig, my pitching coach. Because he had to bring, I had about 55 innings without a walk. If he'd have kept his mouth shut, I probably would have gone 100.
Right.
He had to bring it up. So now it's always in the back of my mind. I mean, if I got two balls on somebody, it was on my mind.
Right.
And so when Mark Hill came up, then I mean, I think it was three wide, but I think it was 3-0, man. I'm not kidding. And so I'm like, here we go. I didn't know if I'd said it or if I was 4 innings away or I didn't know, But anyway, it long story. And the 3-2 pitch wasn't even close.
I want you to know. So you had three. You battled back. You got the full count.
I got the full count through when I was about neck high.
Oh.
And I said, what is that? This choked. And then I looked at the scoreboard where I tied it. I said, I looked at it and go, that's not bad. If you look in the record book for all those years.
Yeah.
It had Christy Mathewson and Randy Jones together.
Yeah.
And I said, God, I think I even sounds better than my own name by myself.
Yeah, no, I'd probably be better.
You know what I mean? I don't know.
Because his would be right below yours.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It would still be there.
It's not a bad point. Yeah.
It would still be there.
No, that was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
It's a tie, I think. Good.
Oh, my gosh. Now, in 1976, you completed 25 games.
Right.
25 complete games. At the end of that year, you pay a price for it.
I do.
This was a question I asked folks on my social the last day. Hey, if you have something you want me to ask Randy, let me know. And one of the questions I thought was a good one, I put it right down on the sheet, was, in retrospect, in hindsight, which is always 2020 as the cliche goes, do you regret pitching as much as you did in 76?
No, I don't regret pitching as much as I did. What I do regret, though, Craig, is that last start against the Cincinnati Reds.
Okay. What happened?
Not that I remember, but I remember. I was warming up for the game. My arm was telling me that it was tired. It was done.
And now, in previous starts, had it been starting to happen?
It was barking at me, but I was still throwing the baseball really well. I had great stuff.
Yeah.
So I just shined it. Oh, another nine.
So it's hurting, but you're succeeding.
Yes.
So, but even then, your arm's kind of saying, hey, Randy, and you're like, hey, shut up, you're doing great. Hey, Randy.
Well, it's just that, it's just me, it's my nature to compete.
Right.
And that day, I remember Roger Craig, my pitching coach, and I said, about halfway warming up, I said, I don't know. And I said, it's telling me probably not to. And Roger walked in and says, give me the ball then. You want me to hand you the ball? You know, and right, you know, between me and you, probably wish I should have handed it to him.
Yeah.
And I went, no, you can't do that. I got to go up.
That was a pride point, right?
Yeah.
Because it's one thing for him to say, Randy, take the day.
Yeah.
Right? It's another thing to say, Randy, give me the ball. Because that means you're giving something up.
Wrong words.
Right.
You know,
right.
Wrong words. Wish he'd have rephrased it, maybe. I don't know. But, yeah, I wish I had made that last start. I didn't need it. I didn't need to, but it was that pride, like you're saying.
And it did the nerve go in that start?
Yes.
Oh, so you felt it on the mound?
Yes. That's when I came out of the game. I came out of the game, like, in the, I think, the fourth inning.
Was it on one pitch, or what was it?
I just, it was a slider. And I just felt it just didn't, you know, it felt awkward. It was a double play ball. And then I just, when Mike Ivey was playing first, he threw it back to me. And, you know, it just didn't feel right. And so I threw a couple more pitches and went, hit Johnny Mack. I said, I just said, I think I'm done. My arm's telling me I'm out of pitches.
When did you find out what the problem was?
Four days later. It was the end of the season. We were up in L.A. And so I had Dr. Job was in that day. And he was just checking my arm. And it was just tired. I mean, my arm was just tired. I just pitched 300 some innings.
Yeah.
My arm was tired and felt fine. And so he's checking my arm, and I'm talking to somebody. And he says, make a muscle, you know. And so, you know, yeah, you make a muscle.
Yeah.
And he's. And I wasn't even looking at him. And he goes, no, I said make a muscle. And I turned around and looked at him. I said, I am. And that's when I realized that my bicep was gone.
Wow.
I had no bicep in my left arm. I went, I don't think this is good. You know.
How was that repaired?
Well, you couldn't repair it.
You couldn't.
They opened me up to surgery. They thought it was a tendon. And they opened me up. They saw that I'd snapped the nerve. And you can't put a nerve together. So they sewed me back up, and they just said, Randy, you said that nerve should regenerate and grow back. If it does, you'll possibly pitch again. And if it doesn't regenerate, you're done.
Wow. What was that feeling?
That was a very sickening feeling, fairly bad feeling.
Because, I mean, you've gone through what you've gone through, and now you're on top of your game.
Well, I'm top of the world. Won the Cy Young, and yet, I mean, you know, about to. And
So you pick up the Cy Young Award. Not knowing what the rest of your career is going to be. That had to be an awkward ceremony.
Well, nobody's, how you feeling, you know, yada yada, feeling fine. Still didn't know, didn't make a big deal of it. I think, you know, like any good pitcher, you can block anything in the world out of your mind, and I pretty much blocked that whole scenario out. I had to wait and see, so let's just live in the moment. But I always felt very positive or confident that it would come back. It would regenerate. Everybody thought it would regenerate. It was still on the nerve canal. There wasn't anything out of whack. He said, actually, the elbow looked pretty good. He was surprised. you know, and finally, I remember it was early December, and I was up in Northern California at a buddy of mine's house, duck hunting.
Yeah.
And we slept on sleeping bags by the fireplace. That night, there were two of us. I rolled up that morning, to get up, and I rolled over on my left elbow, and I looked down. There was just a thread of muscle in my bicep.
Wow!
I mean, a little bitty thread of And I went, you know. Of course, I got up. I didn't go hunting. I was celebrating. Luck, you know, coming back, and you know, and it finally made a full recovery, without some trials and tribulations.
Yeah.
Obviously. 77, I pushed it too quick, hurt it again.
That's what I was just going to ask you. I mean, you had to feel, I don't want to make an assumption. Did you feel a pressure based on what you had just done and the hard way you had picked up, which was unprecedented for our town, our team, to get right back and to kind of beat your body back to the mound?
Well, I had a mindset, even in spring training, starting the season, I had a mindset to kind of, you know, gradually do it.
Yeah.
And it felt good. I mean, my arm felt good. I worked really hard and rehabbed it and had good stuff. But we got up such a horrendous start in 77. I mean, really bad. And then they started talking rumors about John McNamara, manager, and loved Johnny Mack, and they were going to fire him. the way we were playing. And, you know, I made my own decision. I was like, well, I'm just going to step my game up and do my part.
Right.
So I went out and first game, then the next game I beat the Phillies 4-1. I went 9. I just slammed the door on my first 9-inning game. I just said, I'm going to go for it. And then I beat the Cubs, you know, went 9. And then the next start, that's when I snapped that nerve again. Like a rubber band going off. And sure enough, then I hit the DL. Johnny Mac got fired. You know, and everything's going that direction. Gee whiz. And so 77 was a real frustrating thing of, you know, sorting all that out. But I knew the formula of what I had to do to win. I knew how hard I worked, and mentally I knew the approach. And so at the end of hit the 77, I strive for 78 to, you know, give back to be the best that I could be, or as good as I could get.
Right, right.
I don't think it, honestly, it was never the same.
And so I was just going to ask, you never really, it was never quite there.
It would have spurts, but never the consistency in my arm and the release point and just the everything that I needed to have.
Yeah.
Never off, totally there. I mean, I had a good year in 78, a lot, 270 innings or whatever it was, and same thing in 79. I didn't have, you know, the run support or the luck, you know. I think, in 78, Gaylord Perry won the Cy Young.
Right.
With the Padres.
Right.
You know, he was getting like 4 or 5 runs a game, and I'm getting 2, you know. So I ended up 13 or 14 or something like that. And
right.
I had the 8th best ERA in the league, you know, which didn't.
So you count 78 in the good years.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's a good year.
79, honestly. I got a horror in the start in 79. But I bounced back and had a very productive year. You know, not a lot of results, you know, but I know what that takes, too, a little bit of luck and a little bit more consistent than I was. You know, and then in 80 got off to a pretty good start, liked it, you know, and through the 3 straight shutouts, and that just snapped that nerve again in Montreal. And that was really frustrating. That was hard. On me.
Are you thinking at that point that's it?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. I said, can I do it again? Can I rehab it again for the, you know, 3rd time? And which I did. You know, I got traded to the Mets and
right.
Went there. I snapped it again in 81. I snapped it again in 82. And, you know,
right?
In your heart, you want to play. Mentally, I'm the same guy. My legs feel great. My arm won't do it.
Right.
And I finally had to accept it.
Now,
I had to retire.
You had to accept it, but Pittsburgh gives you a little bit of a going away gift, don't they?
Well, yeah, I tried, but it, you know, that was sure was fun going to spring training with the Pirates. But, you know, I did the same thing spring training. I pitched 5 innings one day against the Mets. On my way home, I'd ice my arm down. And on the way home, I'd feel my fingers tingling. And so I just kind of leaned over to check my bicep, and it was gone.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the next day, I just walked in and shook hands with Chuck Tanner and said, thanks for the opportunity.
But they paid you past when you pitched for them, right?
Who?
The Pirates?
No.
Oh, it was an original contract that was traded.
Original
there.
Contract. That was just an invite to camp. But
gotcha. Okay.
You know, but I still had that. I structured it where I was getting paid for 3 more years.
Yeah, okay. That's it. With the Mets. That's what it was. So, which leads me into, I mean, honestly, RJ, when I was thinking about it, I want to talk to Randy. One of the biggest reasons, I mean, we just covered, obviously, the hits. We just went through the hits.
Yeah.
But it's you, the brand. And I've talked to you about this before, the respect I have for you, that you are a guy who has always been one step ahead thinking in terms of business.
Well, you know, and not totally. I mean, you know, I think that I've balanced business, you know, with my baseball career, you know, quite well.
But you were a businessman while you were in
yes, yes. And there's ups and downs to that. You know.
Sure. Car wash?
Yeah, car wash. Had a chain of those and other investments in real estate and everything, you know, then obviously just like a lot of guys in my era, I had some IRS problems.
Right.
So, you get that opportunity to start over, you might say. You know, and in doing so, and that happens, and probably sometimes it's for the best. I mean, sometimes the good Lord, you know, works in funny ways,
mm-hmm.
You know, but I just, you know, workaholic, the same energy I had, but. You know, maybe not heading in the right direction at that point in time of my life, and got a little friendly reminder. And so when I came back from that little financial, you know, problem, I had a better outlook, and I had a real clear idea what I wanted to do.
Which was?
And then get back into baseball. But, you know, my little niche in baseball.
Okay.
You know, let's do a little bit of radio. Let's work for the Padres and get around. They gave me a love, and you want to give back to. And through all this, my rapport with the fan has always been really good. I've always appreciated the fans. It's like they did me in my good years.
Right.
And I never lost sight of that. And I enjoy being around them, and I still do to this day. And I don't think everybody can say that. And I like being out in the community and doing those things. So it all kind of worked out when they started a little pregame radio on KFMB. And next thing I know, I started the Randy Jones Barbecue. And at the same time, I was doing a little PR work for the Padres, doing speaking engagements.
Right.
And it kind of all just kind of blended together. And it was kind of my brand, getting my name out there. And it's doing different things. You keep your name out there, so don't let them forget about you. That type of philosophy.
What was your craziest business venture?
Well, probably my craziest one was they had some tax credits and things when the wind turbines, the wind machines that produce electricity.
Thank you for saying that, because I had looked up. You thought the busy entrepreneur Windmills is on here.
Yeah. And the company was named Fayette up in the Altamont Pass, and I went and looked at it as an investment, you know, for the tax credits and things. And before I got out of there, guy said, "Hey, how would you like to sell a few of these?" And I said, "Well, does that pay pretty good?" And he goes, he looked at me, he goes, "Well, I'll give you $17,500 every one you sell."
Okay.
I'm like, I might be doing this for a little bit. And, so that was probably the most unique thing. I mean, it was a great, great investment. It worked. I mean, but once again, Craig, you know me, and it's not Randy Jones going to go try to sell an individual. The first thing I did is I started setting up appointments and flying CPAs up the Altamont Pass to look at the, you know, venture.
Right.
You know. And so then I'd get them to be satisfied with you know, the investment and see if they wanted to maybe put some of their clients in it. You know. And I'd offer them $11,000 for every client they put in.
There you go. And then you're going to get the 6-5.
Yeah, of course.
Right.
And that's how I did the business.
That makes sense.
Not one-on-one. That's how I did it, and I helped them. If they had clients who wanted to go up, I'd fly them up there and, you know, go through the dog and pony and make them, you know, let them feel comfortable. And that's how. But that was probably the most unique thing that I've ever done. That was amazing.
How did barbecue get in?
That was in that era when I came back in the 90s, and started the radio, and I was doing a little bit of work for the Padres. And I happened to play in I was playing a lot of golf tournaments, a lot of charity tournaments at the time. And I played with one, Upper Deck Golf Tournament. Mm-hmm. Not that I remember, it was Carmel Mountain Golf Course. And I was playing with a guy named Ken Wilson. And Ken Wilson used to be the general manager for Service America. It was a concessionaire at the Murph.
Right.
You know, or Qualcomm. And I never met Kenny, but we went out, and I was playing awfully good. And we won the tournament. We went out in the scramble format. We won the tournament.
Not a surprise with our
game. And so, you know, Ken is all fired. I've never won a golf tournament before, and had his trophy. So we had a beer after we got done. We're sitting there talking, and he mentioned about the next season. He says, "You know, I need one more eatery at the ballpark." You know, I looked up and said, "Hey, I'm at the Randy Jones Barbecue." And he says, "What's that?" I said, "I don't know. I just thought of it." You know, and we both laughed. And I said, "Well, my grandpa's got a barbecue sauce." You know, I said, "A Boog Pal can do it in Baltimore because he just started his in Baltimore."
Okay.
And so I said, "Why can't we do it here?" And so we got a napkin out for about an hour and a half and started to come up with some few concepts. And he said, "Hey, well, let's get together, you know, next Monday." I said, "Perfect. Let's do it." So I went down to the ballpark the following Monday, and 6.5 weeks later, we opened up the Randy Joe's Barbecue. And that's how I got in the barbecue business.
So it's your grandpa's sauce.
It's my grandpa's sauce, but that's all I had, and just a concept.
Yeah.
But I just had the support of Ken Wilson and that, the whole idea. So we set the menu up, and we kind of brimmed all the way through it. And probably the biggest thing is that at the same time that transition with John Morris, Larry Dequino had purchased the ball club. Mm-hmm. And they came in, and that following year, it'd be 95, Larry Lucchino came by to see me. You know, one day during, I was out at the barbecue, and I was out in right field by the flagpole.
Yeah.
And it was kind of slow, you know what I mean? And and I was enjoying a conversation with Larry because I was doing some PR work. And so he got up to leave, and he goes, anything I can do for you? And I said, well, as a matter of fact, yeah, you could move me behind home plate, you know, and make me the mayor of Pottery Street. I said, that wouldn't hurt my feelings.
Right.
And he laughed, and so did I, and I went about my business. And 4 days later, Ken Wilson came by, and he goes, I don't know what you did. He says, but next Thursday, the off day. And I went, yeah. He goes, we're moving you behind home plate. I said, what? He goes, yeah, we're moving all this stuff behind home plate.
And you are the mayor of Pottery Street.
Well, you know, and then it was just phenomenal. We put up those 32 redwood tables, you know, all around.
Yeah.
And they kind of took off. And so did the Potteries. Had some awfully good years in that time, so I think the timing was good. But had great memories of that.
Smell.
Yeah, just the smell. And I loved it. Just walking around all the tables, talking to all the fans. Did that every night. That was a lot of fun.
The success of that led you to get into the restaurant business?
Yes. You know, and back and forth, yeah, catering and some restaurant businesses and things, and you know, and it is a lot of work. But I remember that, and you know, my latest venture was really a licensing deal in Hazard Center,
right?
Because the one advantage I had when I had the big stone launch in Poway and owned it and ran and worked all those hours, I taught myself that you don't want to own those no more, Randy.
Yeah, yeah.
You got out of that one, you know, nice and clean, but you don't want to own them no more, Randy. And so the licensing deal I thought was really a lot of fun with Mark Oliver, my partner there, and tried to make a go of that. And they're a pretty difficult spot, the old Trophies location.
Sure.
But we did the best we could for, you know, 3+ years.
If it was one spot over, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's that last time that you go over all those little humps in the parking lot. That's the one that gets you.
That's really a good call. But, you know, it was a positive experience, I think, for everybody that was there. It was just really a cool place. It just, the economics, you know, caught up with me and myself and Mark Oliver, especially the owner. And who knows? I mean, it might happen again.
Right.
It wouldn't bother me one bit. I think it's a lot of fun. But, you know, on my last birthday, I was 65. And, hey, you know, like I said, this winter has been really good. A little more time off, fewer obligations. And I'm not going to lie and say that I didn't enjoy that.
How do you feel health-wise?
Really good.
Really good, huh?
Really good, yeah.
You feel like you're in the best spot that Randy Jones can be, you know what I mean? Psychological, spiritual, physical, you know, are you centered? Are you where you want to be?
I'm close. I don't know, but I'm as close as I will ever get. I don't know if I'll ever be satisfied. Yeah. I like that edge.
Yeah, you're a driven guy.
Yeah, and I like that edge of not being satisfied.
As Coach K said to me earlier today, he goes, if Randy isn't overcommitted, Randy isn't happy.
Yeah, I think I need that. I need that. I need the challenge. Those challenges, I think, what I look for. You know, it's imperative whatever I do, you know, in business and almost in life. If it's not a win-win-win, I'm probably not going to get involved. I'll walk away.
So now, for a guy that's got as much propulsive drive as you do internally, it amazes me that some of your favorite hobbies involve sitting doing as little as possible.
Yeah.
Hunting, fishing, you know, those are the most solitary, peaceful, outdoors.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you could be sitting in a hunting blind for a long time doing a whole lot of nothing.
Yeah, really cool. I mean, it's just a great time for me. And, you know, remember, I think you think of that context of the deer hunter, the big cat. Most everything that I do involves a dog.
Right.
So
okay.
It's walking.
It's you and the dog.
It's activity.
Too. Yeah.
You know, and I think the one thing that I got to be mentally stimulated by whatever I'm doing.
Yeah.
And that's what I think is going to, you know, keep me as young as I feel. Being around, you know, the San Diego Padre players, you know, in spring training for a few weeks, you know, and I mean, it keeps you young, keeps you alert. I think, and the energy level's high, and I really need that.
What led you to outdoors as an activity?
You know, I think what it was as a kid, you know, like every vacation, my dad was from Weatherford, Texas, and then got grandma and grandpa moved to Midland, Odessa, Texas, so I was a week in Texas every summer.
Okay.
After Little League season. We spent a week with them. My mom was from Arkansas, in Lincoln, Arkansas, right outside of Little Rock. near Fendale. And so, and I'd spend a week there, 5-6 days, on the farm with my Uncle James. And Texas, that's where I learned to, you know, ride horses and infatuated with outdoors and shooting.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed that. And then I'd go over to, you know, same thing over in Arkansas with a little more fishing. Caught my first catfish that were in the pond there at Uncle James's farm. And never forget that. But I got a little bit older, then it was bird hunting, you know, and he had a dog. And I never forgot that.
Yeah.
And so it just is always in the back of my mind. So finally, when, you know, I got old enough and we got settled into San Diego, next thing I knew, I had horses and always had bird dogs. And really doing some things that I just dreamed about and loved to do.
You're deep in. You're deep in. You've had the Outdoor Channel show.
Well, yeah. 5 years. I did, you know, my own show for the Outdoor Channel, which was incredible. I had a great time. Got to travel, go a lot of different places. And I enjoyed it immensely. I mean, it was great.
Now, when I looked up videos of Randy Jones, as I said, try and find him pitching, folks. If you find a good...
Yeah.
In fact...
But you will in the strike zone, though, don't you?
Yes.
I mean, more of me doing some hunting.
Absolutely. Fishing. I find you doing hunting and fishing. You know what's the other funny thing I find, Randy? On YouTube is moms or dads putting up quickie videos of my son's first pitching lesson with the great Randy Jones.
Yes.
And you'll see, you know, here's Johnny the 8-year-old's first pitching lesson. Here's Johnny the 10-year-old's first pitching lesson. And I see that. And pitching coach, or doing that coaching, how long have you been doing that?
I probably got serious in that in 1989. Yeah, probably 89.
Yeah.
I'd done some baseball camps before that, but just the one-on-one private lessons. Yeah, it had to be 88, 89. I started doing a lot of those then. Did a lot of lessons and had a lot of fun. And, in 89, a young man, his name was Carl Goins. He was a catcher. And he went to Mira Mesa High School. And I recruited him to catch some lessons for me.
Yeah.
I did lessons last Sunday. I had him out in my backyard, and I did 7 pitching lessons. And Carl's still catching all those lessons.
Seriously?
Yeah, we started in 89 together. And he's still with me.
And is he sick again?
Can you believe that? Yeah, he was a senior in high school when I recruited him. And really the only sabbatical time we took off is I quit doing it when I was doing the Outdoor Channel.
Uh-huh.
I just wasn't enough time.
Right.
When I had days off, I was taking off summer trying to film.
Right.
And film a show. And so that 5-year sabbatical where I didn't do any. But as soon as that kind of dried up, it would take too much time to continue the Outdoor Channel, produce and do the things that, you know, they wanted me to do it, but I just didn't have the time doing baseball, my commitments. I just knew the reality of it. I wouldn't do a good job and it wasn't going to work. So I gave that up. And as soon as I did, maybe 3 months later, I'm sitting around one weekend and I picked up my cell phone and I called Carl. I said, Carl, what's up? And I said, I'm thinking about it. Which yard? I said, yeah. I might build a mound next weekend. And I said, are you in or out? He goes, man, I got to do them. You know?
Nice.
And so we started doing pictures.
Got the band back together.
Well, yeah, but we do them on Sundays. It's a day, I don't advertise. I mean, I have my 15 kids that I see on and off right now. But I thoroughly enjoy it.
So it's all word of mouth?
Yes.
Yeah. And it's just moms and dads come to you.
Yeah.
They hear it from someone else.
That's typically how it works. And somebody will give them my number. And it's, you know, it's great.
How'd you get Zito?
Basically the same way.
Yeah.
His dad called me one day and wanted to bring his left-hander over. And, you know, and then we're talking about quite a few years ago. And I did a lot of hour lessons there where today it's like half-hour lessons.
Yeah.
But then I was doing full-hour lessons. And, I mean, literally, I would do 8 kids in a day, Carl and I. We'd be out there 8 hours. And from daylight to dark, we would do them.
How do you keep your brain sharp for lesson 8?
I was just as excited about the 8th kid because every kid that walked stepped on the mound was a new challenge.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and what was funny is that, you know, you got to understand that Carl caught all these lessons with me. And I may be talking 2,000 lessons, Craig.
Yeah.
You know, that's 2,000 hours. I mean, like, I looked at him and said, you don't really need me. You can do these.
Yeah.
And he goes, wouldn't be the same. He goes, I might say the same thing, but I'm not going to get the same results, you know. And I heard that 1,000 times from Dad. He goes, I've been telling him that for 2 months.
Right.
And I look over, yeah, but you didn't want to sign in more. You're right.
Sometimes it takes the messengers.
Well, you know, you mentioned Barry Zito in the 2.5 years I had that young man. And what I saw in his eyes, same thing I saw in myself when I was his age.
Yeah.
I saw the commitment. I watched the commitment, his work ethic. And I just saw in his heart and his eyes the desire he had. And and Carl could see it too. And every time we saw him, we'd get all fired up again. You can't help it.
More than his stuff, it was what he had between the years.
I mean, stuff, you know, got better and better as we worked on it. But it was that mental discipline and the ability to duplicate and to be that excited every time I saw him. And, you know, there's that seriousness in his eyes. I just said, whoa. I said, Jesus, you can't teach that. That's something you can't teach.
And did you carry a little bit of a heartstring for him throughout his career?
Oh, no doubt.
So that World Series game then.
Oh, it was awesome.
The pinnacle of that.
Oh, yeah.
Did you see a little of him? Because you had to deal in the last few years with your, and we just talked about this, with an arm that was revolting against you, you know, maybe a deteriorating skill set while your brain is still razor sharp, knowing exactly what you want to accomplish. And I think for Barry, I mean, there were years in San Francisco, he wasn't putting the numbers up he wanted, but he knew mentally what he could do on the mound.
And right.
To me, just his ability to not completely fall off the cliff, which could have happened. He was left off the first postseason roster. He comes back in the second World Series and pitches the game they had to have
right.
to win the World Series.
Yeah, it's so special that you're talking to him. And even through that, you know, like you said, I was the ideal person to, you know, to approach him. I went over spring training, had breakfast with him one time, you know, when he was still pitching, you know, and yeah, if you have a breakfast, talk about it. So he understood, you know, we had some chuckles, but he was still in the right frame of mind.
Yeah.
Even through all that, you know, and I think the one thing, and even I pressed him 2.5 years that, you know, like, hey, succeeding is the easy part. It's how you handle failure.
Right.
How are you going to handle that? You got to be able to be mentally tough enough to handle that failure to really enjoy the successes. And he never forgot that. He figured that out.
I got just two quick ones for you, and these are both from your buddies. when I say, hey, what should I ask Randy? So from Coach comes the Rifleman. He said, hey, ask Randy what it was about Chuck Connors and the Rifleman that he liked so much that he'd be willing to just slap down a $100 bill on John McNamara's office desk to watch the Rifleman.
Well, you know, just a kid growing up, I loved all the Westerns. I mean, I don't care if it was, you know, Jack Pell and Snap Gun Will Travel. I mean, if you were going, what's that? I know. I'm dating myself. But, you know, in the Rifleman was just, I love the Rifleman. I love watching those old shows. And so funny, one day they had a big special, and the Rifleman was on every day, you know, like from 3:30 to 4.
Yeah.
You know, and I was all fired up. And we had to be in uniform, like at 4:10 on the field. Then I told Johnny Mack, I said, hey, I'm probably going to be late a few times this week. He said, well, what for? I said, I'm going to watch the Rifleman. And it's on till 4, but I'll be there. I'll be here right after that. You know, that's going to cost you $100. And so I just reached in my pocket, dropped a seat on myself, so it's Friday. You know? Now, you're going to walk out of this office. And he goes, you're serious? I said, dead serious. I'm watching them. You know, it was a lot.
You needed Netflix.
You didn't have Netflix.
No, you did not, which leads me, actually, another story. This one's from me, and it's a shout-out to my friend, because you will remember this. This was 2000. This is a you and me story. My friend Sean Riley, who was the best man at my wedding, and I'm going to give a shout-out to him, because last weekend, I was just there in Las Vegas, was the Stratomatic Baseball World Championships,
ooh,
which I competed in, winning record, did not win it, because Sean won it. Sean is the world champ.
Really?
Yes, Sean won the World Series.
Get out of here.
He did it. He won the World Championship. His name's on the trophy in perpetuity, okay?
Wow.
So that's a preamble and a shout-out to Sean Riley. In 2000, this was before I was married, and Sean and I played Strat-O-Matic baseball, which if you don't know it, I'm not going to possibly explain it here. I'm just going to say Google it and enjoy the trip, okay? Mm-hmm. Google it and enjoy the trip, Strat-O-Matic, Strat-O-Matic Baseball. They have old-timer sets as well as current sets, and Sean was in town. It was while I was working at Clear Channel.
Okay.
And on the Padre pre-post, and we had the 1975 set, and we did what we always do, which is draft teams, you know, divvy up players, draft teams, and he had drafted Randy Jones. And we had played the night before, and it was 2-2 in the seventh, and he pinch hit for you. And I was like, oh, Randy's not going to like that. Because at this point, you and I had been working together, and I knew you. So the next day, and the reason it was funny about the Netflix thing, because this was before cell phones. So this was, even though 2000, really, no one has cell phones big time the same way. And so having a wall phone was important to our gag. Because my friend Sean was staying at my apartment, and I went to the radio station and said to you, told you the story, and said, yeah, I couldn't believe it. He pinch hit for you in the seventh. You're like, let me at him, basically. He said, let me at him.
And you called him.
Yeah, and so I'm like, okay, this is going to be perfect. So I called him, and he just picks up the phone, not knowing what's going on. You know, I was like, hey, hello. And I'm like, hang on, Sean. Someone's got to talk to you. I'm a nine inning pitcher. What are you doing?
What are you pitching me? Are you kidding me? It's a tie ball game.
It's a tie ball game. Nice to meet you, Mr. Jones.
I can't use my verbiage. Yeah, that wasn't very nice. I love that. Was great. I remember busting his chops.
Oh, that was so fun. That was so funny. That just cracked my butt up. Yeah. I appreciate you forever doing that because you were ripping him for taking out the fictional version of yourself in a pretend baseball game.
I can't believe you did that. You know, and now you tell me he's the world champion.
He's the world champion now.
Just keep my mouth shut now, I guess.
Well, you know, I mean, he does have a good idea when it comes to taking out a pitcher.
Yeah, I guess.
I think that's it, buddy.
All right, good buddy.
Good stuff.
I enjoyed this stuff.
Was that all right?
Yeah.
It was all right.
I like it.
And there he is. There is Randy Jones. Randall Leo Jones, as Ted Leiner would say. And I love that guy. Absolutely love that guy. And we talked about it. You know, it's not all been one giant upswing for Randy Jones. There's been ups and downs. He's gone through things. Marie's been there by his side all the way. Now he's got a new puppy. Now he's got a great place of peace in his life where he's excited, he's active, and he's still rolling, but he's not maybe as bogged down with some of the stuff as he used to be. Love that guy. Hope you enjoyed the conversation. If you missed our first podcast with Ted Leitner, go back, check it out. More cool stuff on there. We are right back next week with another edition of the Craig Elston Podcast. Couple of weeks from now, Julie V coming up. We're spelling it out. We're getting some of San Diego's greatest. They won't all be Hall of Famers, folks. They won't all be Hall of Famers, but we're going to have all the conversation is what we're looking for, and that's what we had right there. Want to say thanks to Mike Glickenhaus, Mike Shepard, Joe Totino, all of 1090 Management, of course, Jay Paris, our digital editor, Bubba's the man in charge. Original music for the Craig Elston Podcast is composed and performed by Bobby Cressy. I'm Craig. We're right back next week with another edition of the Craig Elston Podcast. We'll talk to you then.